But even the most cursory examination of the facts revealed a different story. First of all, the men who held their ground at Ben Het were CIDG troops, not Arvin. And second, while these irregular forces were temporarily able to hold their ground, what had caused the NVA to run away was U.S. air power. TAC Air and B-52s, tons of bombs and napalm clobbering down and inflicting an estimated 3,000 enemy battle casualties. Arvin had nothing to do with the victory at Ben Het, and anyone who doubted it need only have looked at the Arvin relief force sent to the outpost's aid. It didn't even arrive at Ben Het until 3 days after the last shots were fired. Whatever the hype, the truth was that Arvin had failed dismally in its first real test. Some 4 months later, the South Vietnamese Army showed its stuff again during the Battle of Bu Prang. It was another case of a CIDG camp under siege, another case of Arvin leadership showing no offensive spirit, another case of U.S. firepower, 20,000 tons worth, saving the day. And another victory was proclaimed. It seemed almost incredible that at this critical time in the war, the truth of Arvin's inadequacies was not being acknowledged, much less addressed. Despite the billions of dollars spent and the number of American lives lost on the Viet's behalf, it was as if nothing had changed since the early 60s, when the silencing of David Ness and other bearers of bad tidings like John Paul Vann had sent a clear message to those who also recognized the truth, but valued their careers more. Criticism of our ally was forbidden. Wave-making and boat-rocking were distinctly frowned upon, especially in the advisory effort. Diplomacy was the key, a "be polite, we're guests, and remember, it's their war" philosophy, which after 1965 was patently untrue, but which, once adopted, and in the years since, had allowed South Vietnam to hustle the United States as adeptly as the smoothest carnival barker. It was a fundamental flaw in American policy toward South Vietnam. While all along we paid the bills for the war effort and kept our toys and boys coming, we had little real control, indeed took little real control, over the Viet leaders on the receiving end. And we never would, a fact the Viets probably knew better than we did, and a reason why they probably thought we'd never really pull out and go home. While the American advisors should have been, particularly in this period of Vietnamization, romping, stomping, ass-kicking, Emerson and Willis-like sons of bitches growling, "You want a blank check? Okay, I'll give you a check, but I expect X amount back in dividends. No return, no more dough. You got the picture?" In fact, the advisory effort, at least as what I saw of it at 2 Corps HQ and its subordinate units, was overloaded with go-along-to-get-along yes-men. There were a few good studs here and there, but not enough to win any ball games. One very good man was a young military intelligence captain named Harry Riley, who arrived at 2 Corps 22nd Arvin Division expecting to be assigned somewhere as an intelligence advisor, and instead, despite his having had no experience in infantry since he went through OCS 7 years before, was assigned as an infantry battalion advisor. Riley had never called artillery, controlled TAC Air, or requested medevac. The next day, when his new unit got clobbered on a hot LZ, he learned all three real quick, while his counterpart, the Viet battalion commander, lay shaking in the foxhole his Batman had dug for him the minute the first enemy shots rang out. But it was just the luck of that outfit that Harry Riley was the man he was, able to pick up the pieces of a bad situation rather than fall apart himself, and in the advisory stakes, he was unquestionably the exception, not the rule. The problem was that advising, like training, was a job almost totally without glory, and since the full-scale U.S. involvement in the war, generally the only infantry types who got shunted off to the advisory effort were second stringers who more than likely would not get a U.S. combat command slot. Whether or not Arvin recognized this situation per se, I didn't know. But it was easy to see they knew who had the upper hand and how they got it. As the years had passed, with the always diplomatic and polite U.S. advisory effort never establishing procedures to keep its Arvin counterparts in line, that is, preventing them from buying and selling Army commissions, promotions, or U.S. service school assignments, preventing them from taking bribes and demanding payoffs, from stealing their troops' meal allowances, from being promoted and put into better jobs mere weeks after being found guilty of corruption, Arvin had developed exceedingly effective methods to keep their advisors in their place. This was really just a matter of our arrogance. We assumed we understood the Viet mind, and therefore didn't try to. The Viets, meanwhile, watched us carefully until they found out where we lived, and then they went right for it. Keep your mouth shut medals, colorful, plentiful, and totally meaningless Vietnamese awards and decorations that the Americans had no business getting anyway, were a prime example. The Viets dangled these things before their advisor counterparts like a carrot before a horse's eyes. Such pieces of plastic and gaudy ribbon were eagerly sought after by the careerist ticket punchers among us, to fill out their fruit salads and give the impression of being warriors to those not in the know. In fact, the awards were automatic issue, the basic criterion being nothing more than having been there in a job or on a mission. The Viets quickly discovered, too, that their advisor counterparts were loath to be brought to the attention of their superiors in anything less than a glowing light. The very idea that Major Hardass does not understand our country or our people, he has such an embarrassing way, it is disrupting my unit's performance, might be passed up the advisory chain of command, sent shivers up many an advisor's spine, and most felt it easier just to play like the three monkeys than run the risk of being singled out in this way. It didn't help either that every advisor knew his career could suffer if the Viets in his charge did not show progress. As such, it was widespread procedure among the advisors just to inflate the Arvin outfit's unit readiness reports, just as U.S. units did their own, to reflect progress rather than strive and possibly fail to really achieve it. The U.S. command's inexplicable policy that made American advisors 1 to 3 grades lower in rank than their Vietnamese counterparts, and without any command experience in units the size they were advising, was another block to a successful advisory effort. Again, at root was our arrogance. Was it reasonable to expect a Viet Major General Division Commander who had been involved in the war for 20 years to listen to an American colonel with 6 months brigade command experience now just passing through the advisory chain for another 6 months or a year? Hank Emerson had the best idea for rectifying this problem. He believed that not only should U.S. advisors be assigned grade for grade with their counterparts, but that a successful battalion, brigade, or division commander in a U.S. unit should become a battalion, brigade, or division advisor in his very next assignment. Then, since we would have had the experience and paid the bills, instead of pandering to our counterparts, we could have told the Viets what was to be and damn well expected them to listen. One of our most critical failures in Vietnam was in not properly training and motivating Arvin, and Emerson's idea would have gone a long way in the right direction. While still at II Corps, I received a back channel from the Secretary of the Army, Stanley Rezor, who wanted to talk to me when he came to play coup. My superiors, the whole way up to General Corcoran, were beside themselves, thinking I must be really tight with the main man. And while it was true I'd had a number of dealings, all of them good, with Rezor when I was at the Pentagon, the essence of our relationship was he was a man who liked the straight skinny, and he knew he could get it from guys like me or Emerson or Van, the warriors, with no bullshit. Rezor himself had been an army captain and a rifle company commander in Europe during World War II. His philosophy as secretary stemmed in part from this period of his life. He knew how hard it was for men at the cutting edge to get their feelings up through channels undiluted, so he made a point of consulting them directly. So, when we met in play coup and I told him we were losing the war this year much faster than we had the last, Rezor didn't get shook up or try to prove me wrong. Instead, he asked me for my recommendations. Top on my list was my belief that if Vietnamization was to have even the smallest chance of working, The advisory effort was going to have to really smarten up its act and put an end to its musical chairs game of allowing essentially unqualified American officers to pose as advisors for short stints and then go home. And what would sow the seeds for the Senior Advisor Handclasp program that came into being the following year, I suggested that besides being chosen for their competence, combat savvy, and ability to kick ass and get the job done for a change, advisors should have much longer tours and that as an incentive to stay on in Vietnam, their families should be moved nearby to the Philippines, Hong Kong, or Thailand, with the advisors getting a 3-day leave every month to be with them. At the end of November 1969, General Timothy and his principal staff went to Nha Trang to brief Commus Mac V. Abrams, who was visiting 2nd FFV. Grayish in complexion, pudgy, and smoking an incredibly long cigar, Abrams already looked like a beaten man. After all, he had the most unenviable job in Vietnam as promoter of Vietnamization and overseer of our defeat. But with it all, he was still a warrior, and during a coffee break, he called me over. "How's it feel being on ice, Hack?" he asked. "Pretty terrible, General. I'd really like to get back to the field. And I'd be damn careful, General, believe me." "Well, the Airborne Division will soon be needing an advisor," he replied, springing a most welcome hidden agenda. "See Smith and tell him to cut your orders, but I don't want to see you getting hurt, understand? Because if you do," this great old soldier warned, "you'll be right back on ice." "Yes, sir." I went to see General Albert Smith, Abrams J-1, knowing that with Abrams' blessing already in my pocket, the new assignment was a fait accompli. I was right, but my orders didn't come without a price, an incredibly cynical lecture from the J-1. "Go home, Colonel," Smith said. "The war for the U.S. Army is over in Vietnam. You've got all the right credentials. There's nothing more to be gained here for your career, so go home. Go to War College now. Prepare yourself for bigger things." Smith's words were actually heartbreaking. "I'm not over here to prepare myself for bigger things," I wanted to shout at him. "We're fighting a war. I want us to win. What bigger things are there?" I went home between assignments for what proved to be a watershed leave. I'd been away a year. Just off the plane at LAX, I found myself immediately wanting to change into civilian gear. Every step I took in uniform seemed to evoke some snide comment or insult or glare from total strangers. Who's the enemy here? I wondered. I'd never experienced this before. There was a message when I got to the house that Ward just had called. I rang him back, and he flew out from Washington to discuss military men, his work in progress, and another eye-opener for me. During this leave, too, after almost 12 years, I realized that it was time to call it a day with Patty. The Army life had finally won out, as it was probably destined to. I liked adventure. I liked the bachelor life. I wasn't cut out for family life or fatherhood as much as I loved my children, and I did. I felt pretty well vindicated in my decision to leave by the fact that I'd been little more than an absentee husband and father anyway. And since I'd encouraged and supported Patty as the kids got a little older in her long-deferred nurse's training, it wasn't as if she was helpless now. She had a career. In keeping with my totally self-centered logic, this meant she didn't need me, so I was free to go. But I didn't tell her much of this. I just went back to Vietnam, and for all intents and purposes, never came home again. 7 April, 1970. Dear Ward, regarding Arvin, I am convinced that they will never make it. The individual soldier has the potential to be great, but to be great, he needs leadership, and that is the rub. The Vietnamese just don't produce leaders. It is something in their sociological makeup. As a young officer, they are afraid to make a decision. As they grow older and develop and gain rank, they acquire the minimum creature comforts, neat apartment, Rolex, several wives, the little leaguers a Honda, the big boys a Toyota. To have these goodies, they must wheel, and wheel they do. Virtually everyone has a gimmick going for him, designed to produce loot. Now producing loot leaves little time for fighting a war. And after a fellow has his fair share of goodies, who really wants to fight? So as I see it, the gut issue is the Viets do not have the will to fight. Helicopters, modern equipment, and the endless search for the magic panacea that will replace the well-led soldier is not the answer. Leadership is the only answer, and I just do not think that the Viets can produce the type of leadership that is required. The fuckers are too corrupt, too lazy, too stratified class-wise, too indifferent, and too blasé to care. So we can continue to pour in the dollars and our nation's blood. But it will all go into a bottomless pit that will eat and eat and eat and then finally collapse. I say the red, blue, and gold, the flag of North Vietnam, will fly over Saigon within 3 years after the last unit embarks for home. For an infantryman, an Arvin Airborne Advisory Assignment was the top advisor job in Vietnam, because the Arvin Airborne Division was the elite unit of the South Vietnamese Army. The overall quality of the Arvin Airborne advisors was first class. There was a long waiting list among U.S. personnel to get in. Guys fought for a place because it was great duty. You got a good punch on your ticket. Combat was quick in-and-out raids, not months in the boonies. You got to wear a cut-down, very sexy French camouflage parachute uniform complete with a red beret, which, when augmented with big sunglasses and highly polished jump or jungle boots, made us all look like young Errol Flynns. And when in Saigon, you had your own billet with every possible creature comfort. The Airborne Division, elements of which had been formed by the French and fought as early as 1951 in the Indochina War, had been the nation's palace guard since 1955. Throughout this period, the Airborne also had acted as Arvin's theater reserve, playing fire brigade, a brigade or two at a time as required, but always being pulled out and sent back to Saigon as quickly as possible to guard the palace and reconstitute the reserve. As the war progressed and Vietnamization became the rage, more and more airborne battalions found themselves in the field more and more of the time, until, shortly after I joined the unit, only one battalion was left in Saigon at any one time, while the rest of the Arvin Airborne began joint operations with the U.S. 1st Air Cav Division. The Cav provided some training and the helicopter lift, while the Airborne provided the bodies. The hope was that the Cav's great fighting spirit would rub off on the Airborne's leadership, and the Arvin unit would pick up the ball and run with it. Although technically I'd been an advisor for the previous 6 months, the switch from II Corps to the Airborne Division was, for me, a big one. At Pleiku, I'd learned almost nothing about Arvin or the Viets who made up its ranks. I'd been so busy writing reports up there that the only close contact I'd had with the Vietnamese at all was when Colonel Binh had held my hand. Apparently, it was just a Vietnamese sign of endearment, but for me, a big badass paratrooper, it had been truly agonizing to be at a meeting or some lower-level command CP pretending along with General Timothy and the rest of the II Corps advisory staff to be influencing the course of events and feel Bin's soft, tiny hand creep into mine and hold on tight. In Saigon, with the Airborne, initially as a brigade advisor and then as the division's deputy senior advisor, for the first time, I really had to deal in a concentrated way with the Vietnamese character and with how the Vietnamese war machine functioned at the cutting edge. The experience was mind-blowing, and if it could be rationalized at all, it was only in terms of its being a real miracle that there even was a Vietnamese war machine. 15 years before, the French had pulled out, leaving a Viet force of fewer than 100,000 men. There were very few leaders. The French had left the Vietnamese completely unprepared for self-management, government, or defense, and though the United States quickly came in to take care of training and rearming Arvin, in the image of its own armed forces, in the late 50s the Viet Army, specifically its officer corps, was also the pool from which the country's civil service cadre and province and district chiefs, governors, and mayors were drawn. All things considered, These men were the only ones with sufficient managerial skills to turn on the power, control the water board, and keep things running on the political and economic levels. But the constant drain of officers spread Arvin very thin during those formative years, and the situation was only exacerbated by the fact that even the best of Arvin's officers weren't so great in the first place. Most senior leaders had not truly earned their rank, having advanced thanks to the patronage of Emperor Bao Dai and then President Diem, and succeeding generations of officers' appointments were not due to any particular qualifications for the job, but came about through the influence of family, friends, or cold hard cash. Furthermore, since under Diem, the system was so completely centralized that any military operation of battalion size or larger had to be approved by the president himself, there was no room for growth among those in leadership roles, even those who might have started out with genuine ability. Meanwhile, thanks to the American advisor's conventional mindset, which from the outset foresaw the shape of North Vietnamese aggression to be a blitzkrieg attack across the border a la Korea 1950, from the first, Arvin was not trained for the guerrilla war burgeoning within its own boundaries. In fact, in 1961, 80% of Arvin's 170,000 troops were posted along the DMZ in blocking positions or garrisoning Saigon, leaving only some 34,000 Arvin soldiers to actually go out, beat the bush, and fight the incipient war in South Vietnam. Yet now, just 9 years later, Arvin numbered over 1 million men, an instant army zipping all over South Vietnam in helicopters, employing all the latest complicated equipment of a modern Western army. It seemed to me that the level of their effectiveness notwithstanding, and whatever criticism might be justifiably laid on them, the fact that Arvin had been able to adapt to the mammoth changes within the last decade at all was no mean feat. On the other hand, I soon learned that adaptability was probably the Viet's strongest point, when it suited their ends. The more I was with the Vietnamese, the less I knew what to expect from them next. Most of the Arvin officers I dealt with exhibited traditional Vietnamese behavior patterns, which included the inability to rock the boat or kick ass. But many of the more senior officers had also gone to top French schools, and so had developed a decidedly French air as well. They were real smoothies who seemed to have retained only the faults of the French military establishment from their educations during the French occupation. As a rule, these officers were arrogant, blasé, careless, and unpunctual. They often showed an open disdain for efficiency, hard work, and organization. And among the many who were Northerner Catholics, there was a singular lack of interest in the welfare of their mainly Buddhist peasant class troops. When the Americans came, these traits cultivated under the French didn't disappear. Instead, they were layered over, as the remarkable, flexible Vietnamese began to metamorphose into what, in the airborne at least, was a casting director's absolute model of an American paratroop officer. Goodbye, Charles Boyer. Hello, Charles Bronson. The new look was a cigar and sunglasses, white walls and crew cut, excellent military bearing and perfect U.S. airborne slang like, "Hey babe, how's it hanging?" They could have been Hayes's or Emerson's if they weren't Oriental and it wasn't all an act with the specific purpose of impressing their American counterparts. For as much as the Viets had many a career-oriented advisor by the balls with the promise of medals and the unspoken threat of a critical word to his superior, the advisors had one big thing over the opportunistic Vietnamese that the Viets never forgot. The power to recommend or not a Viet for a service school in the USA. It was a number one goal, an assignment to the big PX in the sky where a Viet officer got paid what a U.S. officer of equal rank received, and a small fortune could be amassed while living on the sniff of a rag. At the career course and CNGS, I'd seen it. The Viet students cooked their meals in their rooms, hung their laundry all over the BOQ, and all in all adopted a do-it-yourself approach that, according to my special forces buddies freshly back from advisory tours, saved bucks to buy goodies to send home to friends, family, and all-powerful patrons who could resell them for many times the price on the black market. So to reap this reward, the chameleon-like Vietnamese officers watched and listened and studiously took on all the trappings and habits of the all-American trooper. Their unenlightened tourist advisors would look at them as Narcissus might his reflection in the pool, and be delighted with what they thought they saw. The Viet's adept mimicry was their secret weapon in an ongoing game of keeping their advisors at bay, a game seemingly taken far more seriously than the war. The mirror image approach masked all too well that they in fact had little leadership ability, no initiative to act in the absence of orders. After 25 years of fighting, most everyone who exhibited such traits had long ago been wasted in battle, and no will to win. There was one great battalion commander in the airborne division by any army's standards, a former corporal who'd reportedly fought with the 6th Battalion of the French Army under Major Big Eared at Dien Bien Phu. This CO had worked his way up through the ranks, been battlefield commissioned, and, without French or American training, attained the rank of lieutenant colonel. Thanks to his gutsy leadership, the battalion he commanded was the best in the entire division. Due to his modest Buddhist background, he was known to all as the peasant colonel. The day came that the division needed a brigade commander, and the division CG, Northerner Catholic, Major General Du Quoc Dong, asked for an advisor recommendation as to who should get the job. To me, the only man with the goods was the peasant colonel. As far as I was concerned, he was the ideal choice for any senior leadership position in the airborne. Perfect for the cocky, streetwise, similarly backgrounded peasant kids who'd made up the division, who were proud of their outfit, and with the right leadership could have rivaled any unit in the world. But when I made my suggestion to General Dong, he rejected the idea outright. "He's not politically acceptable. He doesn't even speak English," Dong snapped. "He has no contacts, and he could not be trusted." As an advisor, I had no power to make my advice a demand, so the peasant colonel stayed right where he was. Another arrogant mainstream smoothie got the job, and the war went on being lost. The most frustrating thing about this episode was that in all likelihood General Dong could have given the brigade CO's job to the peasant colonel despite the latter's political unacceptability, and few in the government would have said a word. The government needed Dong, commanding general of the palace guard, as protection against any threat, real or potential, to the present military regime. He was the ace in the hole in any attempted coup. In the numerous coups that had occurred in South Vietnam after Diem's death, it was the fidelity of the airborne division that each time sealed the outcome. And his continued allegiance gave Dong an automatic IOU with President Thieu and tremendous power overall. And power was very much what Dong was into. He was an explosive guy with a violent temper. Whenever he got angry, which was often, he beat the object of his wrath with his swagger stick or whatever else he had in his hand at the time. Once I was in his helicopter with him when his signal officer, a captain, couldn't raise a unit on the radio whom the general wanted to speak with. The captain was a well-connected Mandarin prince whose family had looked after him and made sure he was kept away from direct combat. He'd done the full rounds at Benning, Ranger, U.S. Airborne, Pathfinder, and Infantry courses, as well as Commo School. But he was also a nice boy and a totally competent signal officer. Unfortunately, Dong couldn't see this. All he saw was his will being thwarted, and he immediately began walloping this officer with his swagger stick. The general was in what I considered a truly insane rage, and I could see him beating the kid to death at 1,500 feet without a second thought. Fortunately, I was sitting next to Dong on the same side as his beating arm, so when he raised it for another swing, I just grabbed it and held it down on the seat between us. The general gave me a dagger-like glare with those cold, beady eyes of his that always reminded me of a dead fish. I didn't bother to look back. I just held that shaking arm down until I felt Dong had controlled his rage. I never said a word to him about it, then or ever, and neither did he. When he wasn't busy beating his subordinates, Dong lived like a king. A wealthy man by Vietnamese standards, he had two Vietnamese chefs, one trained for Chinese and the other for French cuisine, and his field general's mess put out 5-star gourmet spreads. From time to time, the chefs would serve up some very exotic Chinese or Vietnamese delicacy like fresh monkey brains or aged raw duck eggs, which were purple and yellow with veins popping out and a smell that would drop a skunk. On those occasions, I'd tell Dong I was going to eat sea rations with my boys. It took me months to deprogram myself from the basic advisory word that you had to learn the customs of the guy you advised and live by them down the line. The idea was sound, but like so much else in the U.S. Army, it had gone to an extreme. Besides, General Dong's feelings weren't hurt when I left him to his pickled, veiny duck eggs. He didn't expect me to parrot his ways. The only people who did, I found, were the Army academics who wrote the book, and many of the tourist advisors. It seemed to me that my boss, Colonel Charles Greer, was among this group. "It is incumbent on the advisor," he would counsel me when I behaved like myself rather than a stupid, submissive toady, "to establish an effective relationship with his Arvin counterpart." To Greer, who as Arvin Airborne's senior advisor advised General Dong, that meant making no waves and playing it Dong's way. The effective relationship that resulted was more a case of Dong, who'd been with the Airborne since he was a second lieutenant in 1951, running circles around the American. Or so it appeared from my point of view as deputy. And ironically, while Greer worked overtime at cultivating his effective relationship with his counterpart, from the first day he seemed to go out of his way to alienate his own command. In his first advisor's meeting as senior advisor, for example, he announced policy changes to include our having to get rid of the wrist compasses most all of us wore. "What is this?" he snarled. "Some kind of cheap fad?" I tried to explain that wrist compasses were essential when conducting air mobile operations and suggested, since he'd been in country only a few days, he'd reconsider. The net result of that was not only did we still have to get rid of the wrist compasses, but we had to prove we'd done so by putting them all on Greer's desk, like dutiful fifth graders. My view of the advisory effort was that, whatever the politics, the facts were that we were leaving and the Viets were staying. We were paying the bills and we were going to see something for our money if it was the last thing the Viets did. The minute I took over as the Airborne's deputy senior advisor, I put out the word that if Vietnamese commanders refused to run their own shows, then the shows just wouldn't go on. The Viets had to come to believe, and to date had had no reason to think otherwise, that their advisors would do anything and everything necessary to assure their missions were accomplished successfully. Now they were going to learn that advisors weren't supposed to, nor were they going to, do anything but advise. It was up to the commanders to make things happen, to call and adjust artillery, to control TAC air, to handle medevac, and to pick up their own chips when things got sticky. The new policy was not well received, to say the least. Fortunately, besides having inherited such great warriors as Old Army First Sergeant Leo B. Smith, 1st of the 327th, with the airborne advisors, I'd been assembling my team since my earliest days at Pleiku, and now I had a lot of my boys at battalion level to override all objections and get the thing implemented. Among these guys were Peeping Tom Hancock, who hadn't changed a lick since we were together in the 1st of the 327th, and whose latest gimmick was pretending to speak Vietnamese to impress his tourist superiors. Whenever any American colonel, general, or visiting fireman came around, he'd count from 1 to 10 and back again very quickly in the language to the nearest polite but oh-so-puzzled Viet. And Ben Willis, whom I'd snatched from behind a desk at 2FFV by trading him for 2 majors, and whose opinion was that Arvin was no better in 1969 than they'd been during his last advisory tour in 64 and 65. The new no-bullshit approach to the advisory effort worked. Once General Dong even told me he knew we airborne advisors were doing a good job because so many of his commanders were complaining that they wanted one or another of my boys at brigade or battalion level relieved for being abrasive and demanding. But while it made me feel great to know we were making a dent, I never questioned that it wouldn't last, and that when the Americans had gone, the only thing the Arvin would have any hope of winning would be volleyball. A game the South Vietnamese were absolutely brilliant at, showed far more interest in than the war, and in the airborne, played most afternoons at division headquarters. The automatic ambush was a brilliant concept pioneered by the 1st Air Cav Division that was just beginning to be implemented in the airborne at the time of my arrival. The device was basically any number of Claymore mines, camouflaged and attached together by a wire, which itself was attached to Prick 25 battery some 50 meters away. Usually an automatic ambush was set up along a trail, and the beauty of it was that long after friendly troops had split the scene, if the tripwire of the device was disturbed, the trigger mechanism at the battery would be set off, and an electric current would shoot down through the wire, detonating all the claymores. Look, Ma, no hands. It was a devastating weapons system. I loved it. The automatic ambush did not run away or search and avoid or play possum. The automatic ambush could inflict max punishment on the enemy at virtually no cost to the Vietnamese. It was just perfect. So I made it my personal campaign to make sure the word got around. I convinced General Dong and Colonel Howe, the Airborne's assistant division commander and my counterpart, of its usefulness. I got an automatic ambush training team from the 1st Air Cav to really get the airborne troops turned on to the thing. I made sure all the advisors knew how it worked, taught their counterparts, and pushed its use. I wrote a fact sheet on it that I sent to scores of colleagues all over Vietnam and wrote an article about it as well that was published in Infantry. In the first 5 or 6 weeks of widespread use in the airborne, automatic ambushes claimed more enemy dead than the human elements of the entire division did during the same period. But then, no more. As usual, the enemy got the message that we had something new out there that hurt, so they stopped using the trails we targeted that they'd almost invariably taken before. From then on, the automatic ambush worked only when we moved into a new battlefield where the enemy wasn't familiar with it, and even then it was good for only 3 or 4 days until he wised up. Yet General Dong kept pushing it to his brigade commanders. I'd listened to him telling them to set these things, and I just couldn't understand it. It was so out of the Vietnamese character to expend energy on something that wasn't netting any return. So finally I asked him, "I'm all for the automatic ambush, General Dong, but you know the enemy's onto it. We haven't had a kill in the last month. Is there any reason why you're still advocating it so strongly?" "Haven't you noticed?" Dong replied. "Noticed what? The great amount of venison and boar and other fresh meat we've been eating recently in our mess?" "So? The animals were killed by the automatic ambush. It's a fine hunting device." In the ER Colonel Greer rendered on me before I left the airborne, he wrote that my extended service in Vietnam caused me to be impatient with Arvin counterparts, which in turn reduced my effectiveness in an advisory role. Naturally, I disagreed. I didn't hit the roof when Dong told me of his new use for the automatic ambush, even if it cost the U.S. perhaps $1,000 for every boar he ate for dinner or sent via chopper to a Saigon friend. I didn't even blink when Colonel Howe took me on his rounds to the province chiefs in our AO to collect his share of the chief's takes collected as tax from all the Viet businesses in the individual provinces, though I think in Howe's case my reasoning was that at least he was up front with his corruption and never tried to bullshit me about it, and because when he wasn't drinking, an admittedly rare situation, he was a brilliant tactician and one of the only decent things in the leadership chain the airborne had going for it. And though I almost cried when I heard that down in the Delta Fire Support Base Schroeder, a Siegfried Line-like position manned by Arvin since the 9th Div's departure and named after fine warrior Don Schroeder who'd been killed there, had been overrun, I did not lash out, even if only apathy could have allowed the VC that success, and it was just such an insult to Schroeder's memory. Nope. The only times I really got angry were when I saw Arvin officers at district or province, particularly officers I'd met when they were in STRAC Airborne Special Forces assignments, who'd gone into a total Mandarin scene. because these types epitomized the worst of Arvind's middle-level leadership, the reason why the FSB Schroders could be overrun, and why Arvind just didn't stand a chance. You could always tell when a Viet had quit being a soldier and become a businessman by the fingernail on the little finger of his left hand, which he'd grow very long, and by the hair he'd start growing on his face, wispy strands that could barely be called a beard, but which said it all about where the guy was coming from. In these cases, what my ER rater called impatience, I preferred to see as a veteran's attitude of cutting through the bullshit. Whenever I ran into one of those ex-stud Mandarin types, I always greeted him with a big smile, and only after I shook his hand and told him how good it was to see him did I bend that little fingernail the whole way back until it broke, and only after I'd complimented him on his beard did I grab hold of those few little strands and yank them out. "Don't you think it's time you go back to a unit, Major?" I always said. Sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't, but at least they knew someone was on to their game. Corruption was a way of life in the Arvin, and it wasn't going to go away, but it took an enormous toll on the leadership chain. As hard as so many of the advisors tried, and even with the help of the few gung-ho caring Viet leaders in the airborne, I saw little progress or hope in getting these guys off their asses on a full-time basis. And if the airborne, Arvin's best-equipped, best-supported, best-advised, most elite division, couldn't hack it in the long term, what could possibly be expected from the average Viet unit? Too many of the officers, from platoon level to division HQ, were the sons, brothers, and friends of bankers, generals, and politicians, extremely well-connected individuals who had allowed the business of war to take a back seat to the business of business. Many of them had their own very successful enterprises going full bore on the side, generally operated by their wives, and their subordinates had but two options: to mill around like lost sheep or get their own piece of the action, even if on a smaller scale. It was not difficult to understand which option they'd chose. Probably the most striking aspect of my tour with the Arvin Airborne was the chance it gave me to look at what the Americans' war had done to the economy of South Vietnam, and how money was made and lost by so many in this unharnessed, war-torn land of opportunity. In the big leagues, there were people like the woman I called Dragon Lady, whom I played blackjack with whenever I was in Saigon, along with John Westmoreland, other longtime American advisors or civilians working for the U.S. in and out of the military, and a number of well-moneyed Vietnamese and Chinese. While most Viets were addicted to gambling, the women often had the biggest habits. Dragon Lady was hardcore. She could drop thousands of dollars in a game and still be back at the table the next night. A sensuous, beautiful, very feminine woman who'd had an eye job to become as round-eyed as her Western sisters, Dragon Lady was an unlikely-looking gambler, but she well fit the mold of most women in Vietnam. While on the outside you got the impression they were all soft, pliant creatures, subservient to their men, behind the scenes they actually ran most shows, and with an iron hand. From the infamous Madame New on down, the women in this matriarchal society were the brains and guts of the nation. As one unusually frank Vietnamese officer told me, "If the women were in command of our army, the war would be over in a year." Dragon Lady was also very well connected. She was the wife of a Viet three-star general, and not hesitant to take advantage of it. Just one of her setups was to pay Colonel Bao, chief of staff of the Arvin Airborne Division, $500 American a month to keep her brother in Saigon as a training officer rather than ever sending him into the field. Over time, Dragon Lady and I became good friends. So good that if I was winning big at the table and she was getting short, I'd lend her whatever she needed. Lending money in a blackjack game isn't exactly wise, but the woman always paid me back. The reason money was no object for her was that her and her husband's main business was laundries, and their company did most of the laundry for the U.S. Marines in I Corps. Dragon Lady also owned a couple of bars on Tudo Street, which were real money spinners and licenses to steal, and another among her very successful deals was trading in gold. She told me she'd met some Laotian pilots who were smuggling stolen gold into Saigon direct from the Laotian treasury in Vientiane. The way the scheme worked was they'd come to her with $50,000 worth of gold bullion that, because it was hot, they'd sell to her for half its value, and which in turn she'd make a killing on by turning it around in Saigon. The very lucrative routine had been repeated 4 times before I knew about it. Dragon Lady was a shrewd woman, and I'm sure I wouldn't have known about it at all if she hadn't come to me one day asking for a short-term loan. As her story went, the pilots had told her the Laotian authorities were closing in on the scam, and since they could risk only one more haul, they were going to make it a big one, $1 million worth of gold, which they'd sell to her for a mere $500,000. Now Dragon Lady was going around trying to raise the cash. I didn't loan her any. In fact, I told her to be careful. The whole thing sounded too easy. But she got the money in loans from her well-heeled friends and soon handed over $500,000 in exchange for $1 million in gold. Of course, as these stories have to end, she was screwed. The Chinese gold broker who assayed the gold found she'd bought a footlocker of lead bars coated with, at most, $10,000 worth of the real stuff. "You warned me," she said when we next met, "but I was too greedy to see. I am very sad that it happened, and I am very sad for my friends who lent me money, but I will pay them all back." And she did, with her laundries and her bars and her other schemes, all directly or indirectly bankrolled by Uncle Sam through our own naivete. Some estimates had it that 1/5 of Vietnam's annual budget was scooped off the top in Saigon, and either sent to overseas banks or used to finance businesses not unlike the Dragon Ladies in all the major cities. Among the smaller time operators, the protection racket was a big moneymaker. On one occasion, a few Saigon cowboys, also known as Slicky Boys, and easily recognized by their Honda motorcycles and Seiko watches, the gold Buddhas hanging from gold chains around their necks and the chunky gold bracelets on their wrists, decided John Westmoreland's bars needed their protection, and that Westy would pay them for the privilege. To cinch the deal, they paid a visit to the New York bar on an evening airborne advisor Tom Hancock, whose battalion was the current palace guard, happened to be there drinking with John. As Westy told me the story later, the cowboys separated the Americans, and while two of them sat down with Westy, discreetly training their pistols on him under the table as they made him an offer he couldn't refuse, a third cowboy covered Hancock with a pistol at the bar. It was almost a replay in reverse of my run-in with the crazy captain from George Company in the 223rd, who was only prevented from blowing my brains out by the quick thinking and boldness of John Westmoreland. Being the brave, cool old warrior that he was, this time around, Westy grabbed the two guns trained on him under the table and pointed them, still in the hands of their owners, toward the floor. Then he flashed Hancock the same do-something look I'd given to Westy 17 years before. All Hancock had to do was disarm the guy covering him, easy at such close range, knock him on his 90-pound ass, and then go help John. But he didn't. Instead, he froze. Meanwhile, the guy covering him quickly got over his surprise at Westy's bold move, rapped Hancock hard across the face, and as blood flowed out of his cheek, warned him not to move or he was dead. So Hancock didn't move, and while the two cowboys with Westy were still struggling under the table to get their pistols back into action, the third hood left Hancock, broke a beer bottle, and went for Westmoreland's face. The result required some 40 stitches. The following morning, Hancock's Vietnamese counterpart sent a number of airborne troopers to beat up the cowboys who beat up Westy and Hancock. For the next few days, he also stationed members of his battalion at the New York bar, day and night, in full gear. It wasn't exactly a subtle way to say nobody messed with the Arvin Airborne or their advisors, but it worked, and there was no further trouble at the New York bar. As time passed, most of Westy's scars disappeared into his already weather-beaten face, and while Hancock's did not, at least he got some character into his movie star's mug. Why Peeping Tom hadn't been up for the game when Westy needed him in the bar was something that initially struck me as odd, but for some reason I never gave it further thought. It was my mistake, however, because it might have taught me some things about the guy that, in future, I would have done well to know. So there was money in gambling and money in protection, but there was also money in money, specifically greenback U.S. dollars and scrip, U.S. military payment certificates. Mac V had extremely strict currency regulations to prevent abuses of the monetary system. On the other hand, Mac V had extremely strict regulations about everything, and I doubted there were many Mac V personnel in Vietnam who hadn't broken one or two of them within their first month in country. It was totally against regs, for example, to even have greenback on you, and woe be to the soldier, officer, U.S. civilian advisor, or journalist caught shopping among the money changers to get the best price for his dollars, rather than putting up with the always depressed legal rate of exchange. When Slam Marshall paid our hotel bill in greenback, he'd committed an offense punishable, at the very least, by expulsion from South Vietnam. Yet green was used in this way every day all over the country by mostly everybody who'd been in Vietnam long enough to know the score. While no doubt the regulations kept money changing from becoming a widespread industry during this time, the general consensus among the old-timers was that currency manipulation was a fact of life in Vietnam, and only a fool would not take advantage of the system to get a better price for his scrip or that little leftover greenback he had after R&R. For the Vietnamese, the currency manipulation game was far more serious because it often involved people's life savings. Thanks to the Americans, inflation in South Vietnam was so outrageous that the piastre was not worth the paper it was printed on. As such, despite another currency regulation which stated that Vietnamese were not authorized to hold U.S. military payment certificates, many times Viet officers would convert their pay or their savings from piastre into MPC and have their counterparts hold it in the advisor's safe. Of course, holding MPC for the Viets was also in violation of the currency regulations, but since getting your Vietnamese counterpart to do anything positive toward the war effort was often as hard and painful as pulling teeth, what better leverage could you have than his life savings locked in your safe? The practice worked fine unless or until the safe was knocked off, a calamity that befell the Arvin Airborne Advisor's safe and, by extension, one of my majors who'd stashed $1,000 in MPC in there for his Viet counterpart. It was a bad situation for the young advisor, a straight-arrow guy and a real comer in the Army. If he took responsibility and paid the guy back himself, he'd be out several months' pay. If he told his counterpart the truth and didn't make good the dough, he would lose face and thus his effectiveness. And if word of what happened got to Colonel By the Book Greer, the major would be in serious trouble separate and distinct from his dilemma over getting his counterpart his money back. So he came to me. Besides never having been into court-martials, it seemed to me to be a hell of a lot easier and fairer just to find a grand to replace the one lost than to prosecute this guy and ruin his career. So I organized a truckload of beer at the PX through a good airborne sergeant and sold it to John Westmoreland for the cost of the beer and $1,000 neat. Westy would have paid 10 times that price on the black market, so naturally he snapped up the offer. Strictly speaking, the transaction made me a black marketeer too, but my conscience was clear. I was helping out a subordinate in a jam and a good friend in the deal. The major got the dough back and his Viet counterpart was never the wiser. I did, however, put a stop then and there to the practice of stashing counterparts' fortunes in the advisor's safe. At the end of April 1970, a warning order came down from Mac V. Prepare a task force from the Vietnamese Airborne Division to launch an attack into Cambodia, highest priority. The cable said that Arvin Airborne Forces would enter Cambodia as part of a theater Cambodian operation with the mission of finding and destroying Hanoi's central office for South Vietnam, COSVIN. Throughout the war, COSVIN had been, in the minds of the U.S. command, the communist equivalent of Mac V headquarters in Saigon. The powers that be figured if it took such a mammoth apparatus as Disneyland East, as Mac V was known, to conduct the war on our side, surely the North Vietnamese would have a similar structure to command the forces on theirs. No one seemed able to grasp that Cosvin was more than likely just a few guys on bicycles, and as I reread the mission statement, I concluded I was having some sort of mild, mad fantasy. After all these years, I thought, no one truly believed that Cosvin existed in such a convenient or conventional way. And no way, I thought, would the airborne or anyone else be invading Cambodia, certainly not after all these years, without a declaration of war. Invading Cambodia meant violating the sovereignty of a neutral, albeit nominally so, nation. Something I was sure America would never do. But just then Colonel Howe came into my tent waving a parallel order. "I know, Colonel," I told him, "but don't worry about it." "But we've been told to develop plans." "Fine," I replied. We went over to the operations tent, and in about 15 minutes we laid out the general concept. It was just a quick Fort Benning exercise, as far as I was concerned. I'd left fantasy land. But 2 days later, we received instructions that the operation was a go. General Dong had conveniently made himself absent from the division, so Colonel Howe was to lead the airborne task force. I, as his advisor, would go along. Colonel Howe was most excited. "We must go to Saigon to brief the president on the plan," he enthused. I accompanied him as far as the presidential palace, but when Howe went in to talk with Tu, I went out on the Saigon streets to hunt down Don Baker, my good friend who shared my birthday and was the electronic Ernie Pyle of the Vietnam War, as ABC Television's top war correspondent. I had to tell him we were going into Cambodia. I didn't care if the plan was top secret or that to discuss it with him would be a serious security violation. I wanted Don to be there with his camera and his tape recorder, because somehow I thought that would stop it. Somehow I believed that if he scooped the story, we wouldn't go. But I didn't find him, and he didn't get my message in time, and the next time I saw him was on D+3 or so, when a helicopter full of correspondents, the victims of a total press blackout for the first few days of the operation, spilled out onto Cambodian soil. And by then, of course, it was too late. The Cambodian exercise was the straw that broke the camel's back for me about the war in Vietnam and the direction America was heading. Militarily, the operation was correct. A basic rule of counterinsurgency is to deny the insurgent a sanctuary, and as David Ness had warned Ambassador Lodge 6 years before in his memo of 10 March 1964, a communist insurgency having access to an active sanctuary has always prevailed. But what was wrong with it, besides the fact that it came 5 years too late, 5 years in which our army lost the lion's share of its great NCOs and stud officers, and the American people lost their stomach for the conflict, was that the way it was done violated all the principles the United States of America, the country I loved and I soldiered for, was built on. Cambodia was a neutral country. Our incursion at this time in the war, with no prior notice to the fledgling Lon Nol government or even to our ambassador to Cambodia, was not, to my mind, any different from the Japanese bombing Pearl Harbor. In my estimation, the exercise was an immoral, ill-thought-out venture, and one that would prove to be both an expensive tactical Donnybrook and an irreparable strategic defeat. The basic thrust of the attack consisted of the airborne task force using U.S. 1st Air Cav choppers, conducting air mobile assaults onto multiple LZs inside Cambodia with armored columns linking up with us. I thought the armored bit was most appropriate. The essentially German blitzkrieg technique was not unlike that the Nazis used to invade Poland. We jumped off and encountered little more than token resistance. According to the caught-in-the-middle Cambodians, the enemy had abandoned the area the night before by vehicle, bicycle, or foot, and headed west. The mission had been compromised, but it was little wonder. Though most of the task force elements had had less than 24 hours' notice of the plan, the South Vietnamese command structure was so heavily infiltrated with VC that news of the impending attack may as well have been broadcast over PSYOP's loudspeakers. This was not to say we didn't have any contacts. But for the main, it was hit-and-run stuff, mines, booby traps, and snipers left behind in a deadly screen to draw blood. And draw blood they did. Just one example was Hancock's battalion, which was sent into Cambodia with 425 troops, got 100 replacements during the 60-day mission, and though they never even saw one good fight, they still came out with only 200 combat-effective men. On the second day of the operation, one of our fighter aircraft got hit while conducting an airstrike. The pilot ejected, but as he came down, his parachute became entangled in a tall tree, leaving him dangling in midair. We saw this from my chopper and flew to the rescue. The only way to get the guy was to hover just at treetop level, some 60 feet off the ground, and pull him up into our bird by his chute. The pilot himself couldn't help. The emergency eject system in his jet had catapulted him out, but left his legs, from just above the knees down, inside under the instrument panel. Not an unusual accident, but a small design flaw. So the guy was unconscious, if not dead already, gushing blood straight down, with no chance of survival unless we got tourniquets on what was left of his thighs and got him some medical attention. Then I saw on the ground North Vietnamese troops, complete with camouflaged pith helmets, running toward the scene from all directions. Both door gunners of our chopper took them under fire, but they kept coming, and a wave of despair washed through me, not just for the pilot, but for the whole damn show.